cornworms. They're still alive. Need a little water. Let's try the second gauze, shall we? Just a little side note. 2 billion people in the world eat bugs, and I'm one of them. Because here we go.
Insects. A sustainable, equitable, and nutritious source of protein for a fraction of the carbon footprint of livestock.
Oh, crickets. Oh, nothing. Oh, awesome.
Be a net zero hero. Eat the bugs.
Hey, everyone. In today's video, we're going to be talking about Hollywood celebrities that want you to eat bugs. So, last night I was home alone, and I decided to go for a trip down memory lane and just watch some old movies from, you know, some thrillers, some horrors that I used to be somewhat of a fan of back in the day. Now, you know how you'll watch a movie when you're a kid that you think is really funny, and then you watch it as an adult and you're like, God, that was stupid. Why did I think this was funny when I was little? Like, I'm sure all of you have experienced that at some point, right? And then there are movies that you did not appreciate when you were little. Maybe you thought they were boring, but then you see them 20 years later and you find them profoundly more interesting or more insightful than you did when you were growing up because, you know, you have the maturity to understand it better. And then you go back and you watch other movies that were kind of okay when you were growing up and you want to go back and watch them to see if you feel any differently decades later. And it's like, nah, it was okay. You know, it is what I thought it was like 20 years ago. Anyway, one of the other movies that I decided to rewatch was this movie starring Nicole Kidman called The Others, which is kind of a horror movie, I guess, but not like a slasher. It's like a spooky movie. And I remember it being pretty decent. It wasn't great. It wasn't M. Night Shyamalan's best film, but it wasn't a bad film either. Anyway, I was trying to figure out in my own head, like, what could they have done to make this movie better? You know, like, maybe having the actual people that are alive at the end to be set in a different time period, so the ghostly subplot occurs over several different generations, you know. But anyway, so I'm watching this movie, trying to figure out, like, there's something off about this movie. And then I realized what it was. It was Nicole Kidman. Like, I realized all at once something that I've always known but had never really sort of actualized, which is that Nicole Kidman sucks, like, as an actress. It always seemed like she started to play the exact same character in every movie that she was in. She always played this kind of strong matriarch of her community that's holding it together until her husband gets back from the war. Like, it was always the same kind of character. Anyway, so I started thinking a little bit more about, like, astroturfed celebrities, you know, like actors that you hear about all the time that are, like, so famous. You know, they're, I once heard them described as blue ribbon actors, like Meryl Streep, you know, one of those names that you always hear about, you know, for like 40 years they've been at the Oscars. But like in the case of Meryl Streep, can any of you listening right now honestly name a single good movie with Meryl Streep in it? Hell, can anyone name a single movie with Meryl Streep in it? Doesn't even have to be a good one. I'm sure there are like some 75-year-old white boomers out there that do like Meryl Streep. But the point is, you know, these actors are super astroturfed, right? Like they have an entire industry that's propped up to astroturfing them. And relating to sort of all of that, this selfie was, you know, taken a few years ago at one of the Oscars. And I remember seeing something that I had never seen before, and it warmed my heart because I'd been feeling like this for a long time. I saw the entire internet, like, basically roasting them. Like, who are these weirdos? Who are these multimillionaire, you know, adrenochrome drinking, like, creeps? You know, you've got Ellen DeGeneres. She's a freak. And then you've got Meryl Streep, who's just this, like, this actress that we've all heard about, but no one can name a single good movie that she's in, you know, just some like stuck up, fart sniffing Hollywood liberal type. You know, you've got Kevin Spacey in the background. Yeah, his case is a bit more complicated, but you know, the less said about him, the better. Then you've got Angelina Jolie on the back right there. Her face is obscured, but that's Angelina Jolie on a double dose of adrenochrome that night. You know, they had to, usually it only takes like 2 to 3 babies per month that they have to drain to prop Angelina Jolie up. But, you know, for the Oscars, she wanted to look as human as possible, so she had a double dose that night. I'm not sure if it was like a boy or a girl that they sacrificed or whatever, but yeah, she's there. I'm not even sure what this is, but if someone said, like, you have to meet this person, you know, for any reason, in any context, if I had to be alone in a room with this person, I'd probably bash my head against a wall until bits of white brain matter are just flying everywhere, rather than having to be subjected to that person's opulence. Now, I know I said before that most Hollywood actors are astroturfed, which is true, but paradoxically, they do still have thousands, you know, millions worldwide of people that will pay money to go see their Hollywood movies. You know, they paid money to go see 80 for Brady. You know, they were excited to see Sally Field. You know, they haven't seen her act in years. They were so excited, you know, oh, golly gee, I got to see Sally Field. Like, I remember a few years ago, I'm not sure what year it was. I think it was about 2015, 2016. Leonardo DiCaprio had not yet won an Oscar. And there were guys, there were sub-5 males out there that had strong opinions about Leo deserving to win an Oscar. Like, man, he still hasn't won an Oscar. Like, you know, nothing is right with the world until this guy who's worth like $500 million that, you know, wouldn't spit in your mouth if you gave him your life savings. You know, their heart bled for the fact that he hadn't yet won an Oscar. And I'm looking at these people like, what is wrong with you? I was like, it's not okay that you care about this. And yeah, those are the kinds of people that are out there. I remember when I was a teenager, I was dragged along to go see, it was the second Fast and Furious movie, Too Fast, Too Furious. And I don't remember who suggested it, but someone said we should all go watch Too Fast, Too Furious. And because I was a teenager, I went along with it, you know. And I knew I wasn't going to like it. I knew it was going to be bad. And it was. So the movie starts, and I'm not even following it, right? Like, every joke is, like, super cheesy, and the plot line was silly, and the, you know, tacked-on love story. Every single stupid cliche that you could get in a movie was in it. And I'll never forget, I remember looking around at the room as I'm sitting there, you know, suffering through this awful comedy, and I began paying attention to the way that people were being prompted to laugh by the cadence of the writing of the movie, the way the jokes were timed, that it was very similar to a laugh track, except the cadence of the actors would prompt the audience to know that a joke had just been said. And you could tell it wasn't like that thing when you're a kid in primary school where, you know, one of the kids starts giggling and you all start laughing because it's contagious. This wasn't like that. This was a programmed response to, you know, the stimuli on the screen. And I also know this because I remember afterwards, I was so fascinated by what I had just seen. I said to one of my friends who was kind of an NPC, I said, you know, what did you think was funniest about that movie? Because he had been one of the people laughing the whole time. And I remember he couldn't name a single joke he actually thought was funny. But anyway, suffice to say that from about the early 2000s onwards, I progressively stopped going to see movies. I stopped caring about the latest Hollywood film. In fact, I can probably count on one hand the number of post-2010 movies that I've even watched. You know, I've never seen any of the superhero movies, thank God. You know, those Spider-Man movies, whatever. I would never, ever, ever subject myself to one of those movies. I never saw The Hunger Games. I never saw Avatar. I'm not saying that all of these movies are bad or that, you know, you have bad taste if you like one or two of them. I'm just saying. But one of the post-2010 movies that I did watch from start to finish was The Wolf of Wall Street. And I remember this would have been, you know, 2014, 2015. I don't know how I caught it, but I was watching an Ellen DeGeneres interview. Anyway, she was interviewing him about The Wolf of Wall Street and, you know, his experience making it and everything and what the movie was about. Now, when the movie came out, was probably, I would say, the lowest point in my life. I was probably at the lowest point I've ever been back in 2014, 2015. That was my, that was like my peak doomer poverty, you know, living in a shoebox apartment sort of era. And one of the things that the movie did quite well is it challenged the viewer by use of the character design about whether or not they would choose an honest life and make, you know, $50,000 a year, or would they be willing to, you know, sacrifice morality to, in a sense, sell their soul, but in return have everything they've ever wanted, you know. The greed is good kind of metaphor that that Gordon Gekko sort of delivered in his speech in Wall Street. You know, it was not exactly an original movie, but it did do a good job of presenting that conundrum. Anyway, Ellen invites Leo onto her show to talk about the movie and supposedly to talk about the themes of the movie, to talk about, well, what the movie's about, to which this question of what decision would you make, being sort of the moral center of the film, you would think that's what she would ask Leo about. But what I noticed is that she talked about a scene. There's a scene about three quarters of the way through the movie where his character, some of you have probably seen it, his character gets high on lewds and drives his luxury vehicle under the influence and crashes it, and then there's a scene where he's like meant to be paralyzed by all the drugs he's on. It's a whole thing. Anyway, all she could do, the only thing that she seemed focused on, was how funny it was seeing her friend Leo, because, you know, they're friends behind the scenes. She thought it was so funny seeing her friend Leonardo DiCaprio laying on the ground, right? She wasn't even entertained by the character, the Jordan Belfort character, being incapacitated like that. She wasn't even laughing. You know, it would be one thing to say that you liked the movie and your favorite scene was when the character was passed out on lewds, but no, she was just laughing at the fact that it was Leo on the ground shooting that scene. And the reason why she had no insight into the theme of the movie, the reason why she had no actual sort of insight into anything other than laughing, ha-ha, at the scene of her pal Leo lying on the ground, was because that whole bubble, that whole scene, is just full of people worth hundreds of millions of dollars that have their ego stroked every day by an entourage of people telling them that the world cares about them and that they're so interesting. You know, I'm sure that most of these celebrities think that the entire world, you know, the peasants of Cambodia, you know, can't wait for the Oscars. I bet they think the entire world cares about it because they live in a bubble where everybody cares about it, you know? And it's sad, but it's gross at the same time. And yeah, honest to God, I can't watch a lot of movies that even once upon a time I liked because I found out how absolutely unbearable a lot of these actors are, you know? From time to time, they'll get pulled over by the police, you know, for speeding on their private island. And their response to the cop is like, do you know who I am? Do you know what I can do to you and have you fired? Like, they're terrible people, most of them. Not all of them, but, you know, so many of them are. And at the very least, they're self-centered. They're narcissistic, you know. Even the ones that you wouldn't think are narcissistic often are. Like, I grew up in New Zealand, obviously, not to repeat something that you all know, but the guy who plays Grant in Jurassic Park, Sam Neill, he actually comes from the same part of New Zealand. He grew up in like a neighboring town to where I grew up. And because he kind of leans into his New Zealand heritage, you know, he often comes back to New Zealand. He spends, you know, a large amount of his time living in his hometown. He's sort of a local hero in a sense, you know. He's like a local icon who went to Hollywood and made it big, and he's the guy from Jurassic Park, you know. So Sam Neill's a bit of a New Zealand hero there. Anyway, back in 2004, when I was in high school, it was like my last year of high school, he came to our school, to our assembly hall, and he was going to give like a speech, a presentation, you know, that sort of a thing. And it was kind of a big deal, you know, to have Sam Neill come to your school. So we showed up at the assembly hall and he's there. And when we first walked in, there was a little bit of a buzz, like seeing Sam Neill sitting in the front of the assembly hall. But then he starts speaking after, you know, he gets introduced and then he starts talking. And it's this like long-winded, you know, the cable news channel in America, C-SPAN? It was a very kind of C-SPAN presentation, you know, about 20 minutes of him rambling about growing up in central Otago. And I don't even remember like the first hour or so. It was all a blur of him going into like the minutiae of going to, I think he said he went to an all-boys school or something. I don't know. I don't remember any of it. It was, I just remember like getting more and more bored. And I remember looking around and seeing everyone just like slumping deeper and deeper into their chairs. Like, oh, you know, how long is this going to go on for? But like, it wasn't even the fact that he was, you know, it wasn't even the fact that the first hour was him just, you know, sounded like he was reading his own Wikipedia article, like an AI voice of Sam Neill reading his own Wikipedia. As the presentation went on in this like monotonous voice that he was speaking in, he actually began kind of musing about the way he was being covered in the local newspapers in the South Island of New Zealand. Like, you know, the Otago Daily Times has been speculating that I am going to make a purchase of summer fruit orchards, but this is not the case, you know. Me and my lovely wife, Nori, of 15 years, we are actually taking a much more keen interest in some vineyards down near Cromwell. Like, this was the speech that he was giving us. And by the end, we're sort of like looking at each other like, who is this guy again? Like, why are we here again? Anyway, I feel like I might be singing to the choir because I think that most people who listen to me would probably agree that celebrity worship is cringe, but that doesn't mean that it's not everywhere. You know, I see it on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. You know, YouTube used to do this thing. I'm not sure if they still do it, but every time you would log in, they would promote you those late night talk shows, and the algorithm would promote them just constantly. I just can't relate to the people who actually do watch those kinds of videos because they have millions of views. You know, even though the YouTube promoted them aggressively, they still get millions of views. Anyway, what I wanted to do in today's video is hammer home the different kinds of celebrity worship that you see. Like, for example, there's the worship of professional sports players. Now, there's nothing wrong with liking sports or watching sports on TV. That's fine. But you know the people that obsess over it, that, you know, go around wearing the names of other men on their shirts, you know, that type of thing. But I don't feel I need to harp on that too much because I feel like most people are aware of how cringe that is. Another form of celebrity worship that you don't hear as much criticism of is the worshipping of singers and musicians, right? Like, most people know how cringe it is to be a Swiftie, you know, obsessed with Taylor Swift. You know, most people will mock the Swifties. But a lot of people will defend their own taste in music, okay? They'll make it seem like their taste in music is especially deep and insightful. And the reality is that most songs, okay, the lyrics to most songs can fit on a single A4 sheet of paper. Like, think of the deepest song that's ever been written. It can be quantified on an A4 sheet of paper. The lyrics cannot be that deep by definition because it's only one page of writing, okay? Like, just because a song can produce a powerful sense of nostalgia, or because there's a lot of emotions that went into writing the song, that doesn't make the lyrics themselves that deep, right? You often hear this from teenage girls, you know, oh, I love his music, it's so deep. But it's like, if it was so deep, then you wouldn't understand it, okay? If it was so deep, then why can a 15-year-old girl understand it? It's like, you know, the theory of relativity is deep, okay? And most teenagers wouldn't understand it. So, yeah, hero-worshipping of musicians, that's something that probably doesn't get talked about enough. But the one that I'm really focusing on today is the worshipping of actors. And overall, I would say the worshipping of movies. This is personal for me, okay? This is personal for me. Because I think, like a lot of people in like the millennial, Gen X, Zoomer generation, we often grew up watching movies that at a kind of subtle level, it's almost like we have nostalgia for fictional experiences, right? Like, what I mean is there's an entire generation of people out there that, whether they're conscious of it or not, they have nostalgia from when they were home alone in the suburbs of Chicago, right? Like, they have nostalgia from when they were defending their home against two burglars. Or, you know, maybe there's other kids out there that have nostalgia from when they were really little, like really, really little. They remember going to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Like, this is a real phenomenon, okay? There are people out there that have nostalgia for experiences that are totally fictional, totally made up. Those things never happened. To quote a movie, it's like that one, A Beautiful Mind, where the psychiatrist is explaining that to someone with schizophrenia, it may be very difficult for them to start taking medications because once they start going on the meds, they start to realize that, you know, so many of their most cherished memories are an illusion. They never happened. That the times in their life that they thought they were doing the most important thing was just a product of their psychosis. That, you know, their happiest memories were really just them alone in a room talking to themselves. And it can be like waking up from a good dream. And I think that there's a lot of people out there that, whether they're really conscious of it or not, they have nostalgia for things that didn't exist. Like, you know, the storyline in video games, okay? Video games is especially common amongst Zoomers and Millennials. Like, I remember in high school, you know, there was a game called Final Fantasy, and my gaming-obsessed friends talked about it like it was real, and they had nostalgia from playing it when they were in middle school, and now they're in high school, and to them, the storyline of Final Fantasy was almost a kind of stand-in for reality. And this is all sort of a byproduct of the worshipping of the celebrity, the worshipping of the fakeness. Anyway, thank you for listening to today's video. You can expect to receive a relatively frequent schedule of videos by my standard, which is relatively infrequently. But, you know, I used to go by the philosophy of only post a video when motivation strikes, you know. But you see, the problem with that is that when motivation does strike, as soon as you go to record a video, you're like, where's my microphone? You know, I haven't touched my microphone in months, and you find out it's buried under a pile of clothes, and you're like, ah, to hell with it. I'll do it later. I'll record the video later. And by that time, you've lost interest in doing it anyway. It's like, you've got to keep consistently making videos to stay sort of in the game. Right, so like when motivation does strike and you want to talk about something, it's easier to do so because you're in the groove of making videos at least every, you know, few weeks or so. So that's what I'm going to be doing.